And now, from the gay capital of the Western Hemisphere, KSAN presents The Gay Life. Good morning, I'm Randy Alfred. Later in the show, we'll talk to Sharon Mills of Women's Alternative Health Services about a lesbian clinic that she and her colleagues are planning to start in San Francisco. Our first guest this morning is Commissioner Joe Daly of the San Francisco Board of Permit Appeals. Good morning, Joe.
Good morning, Randy.
You've been being appointed to the Board of Permit Appeals last year was only the latest of a long series of involvements and activities you've had in the gay movement. You've been very active in Democratic Party politics, a member of Alice B. Toklas. You were an officer for quite some time. And you're also a longtime friend of our newly inaugurated mayor, Dianne Feinstein, so that you're, frankly, very well connected in the San Francisco political scene.
Well, that politics is something that is a variable. I would say that's possibly true this morning, but as Leo McCarthy is discovering, everything changes in politics. It's a constant change. So you never know. Maybe tomorrow that won't be the case, but we will always be longtime friends.
One of the things that's been widely maybe tomorrowed around town is that you are being considered for a position on the police commission, since the mayor has promised to appoint an openly gay or lesbian police commissioner.
That's a really interesting experience in my life, that this rumor is going around town, because it demonstrates the fact that people really do believe what they read in the paper. I mean, the power of the press is incredible, because once that's in a column in the paper as a suggestion, word spreads quickly. And the truth is, the mayor and I have not discussed that position. I have not applied for that position. I have not asked for support for that position.
However, if suppose that she did come around to you tomorrow or next week and said, Joe, I've interviewed a couple of other candidates and so forth, and none of them are as good as you. I think that you're the person who should be on the police commission, and I'll appoint someone else to take the Board of Permanent Appeals. What would you do in a situation like that?
I'd certainly want to spend some time discussing with the mayor the particularly special interest that I have, and that I hope whoever gets that appointment has, and that's police community relations. That's been my experience with the police department in the past, and I'm very concerned about police community relations.
Did you mean police community relations in terms of an established unit at the Hall of Justice with perhaps police community relations officers in each district station, or do you mean police community relations training for every officer on the force?
I'm speaking about a police community relations unit very similar in the successful respects that we had before, where there are certain officers that community people know they can speak to openly and honestly. And I'm not speaking just of the gay community. I'm talking about women and the huge problem of rape in this city, by the way. I'm talking about the Asian people in our city. I'm talking about the Latino community. I mean, we have a terrible problem right now in the Mission District, and I think whoever takes the position of police commissioner is going to have to be somebody who really recognizes those other communities and is accessible for the problems with the gay community, and is accessible, but has an overall view of this city, because we have a very small city here, and the population is dropping. And I get very confused when people self-ghettoize themselves or only concentrate on a very limited issue, because all of us really have to live together, and our police department has to protect all of us and has to be able to deal with the problems that exist between our communities.
What would you say are the major police problems in the city, not just for the gay community, but in general?
I would say the major police problem in this city is that not enough officers live within the city.
It's only around 40% that do live in the city.
I would say that would be even more than is really true. I thought I was exaggerating 6 months ago, but
well, I got one figure of 58% live in the city from Bob Berry of the Police Officers Association. I mean, live outside the city, he said. 58% live outside. And Henry Friedlander of the Police Department said 62%. And I thought that was close enough that they were essentially the same figure.
Perhaps. I heard that less than 500 members of the POA live within the city. Now, that's pretty significant to me.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the problem, there's two problems involved in that. One of the problems is that police don't necessarily consider us neighbors or their friends. So it's not their neighbor or friends who are being ripped off or raped or burglarized. It's just a job. And it's like an armed militia coming across the bridge. The other part of the problem is that San Francisco has an extremely unique geographical makeup as a peninsula surrounded on three sides by water. Earthquakes happen to be one of my hobbies. And a four-point earthquake that would hit just in the right spot won't knock the bridges down, but it will. The access roads are built on fill, and they could become non-accessible. There's that situation.
Even if they were safe, it might take hours or days to discover that they were safe.
Well, and besides that, if I was a wife in Petaluma and the police department called to say there's been an earthquake and there's looting and there are rats that have come up from the gutter and there are people are just going crazy, I'd say that my husband was at the bowling alley and couldn't be reached. I mean, I'd hardly encourage him, even by helicopter, to put himself into that kind of a position. I believe that police officers and firemen would choose voluntarily not to. I believe we'd have more help from the Japanese and quicker help across the Pacific than we would across the bay. And it sounds silly, but if you've ever studied what happens in the cases of earthquakes, and you really need to have your protective services around, because it wasn't the earthquake last time, it was the fire. And I don't see firemen getting into helicopters to come here and help.
Right, but when San Francisco passed a stringent residency requirement in the early 70s, the voters of the state passed a state constitutional amendment prohibiting any municipality from forcing its civil servants, whether or not they were public safety employees or not, from living in the city. So it would require a state constitutional amendment.
No, I don't think so. I think that although it would take a long period of time, and although I think that a preferential point system should be instigated quickly, and I mean for promotion and for entrance. And that takes a long time to weed out the suburban people. It might take 15 years, but we also may not have that tremendous need in 15 years. I also don't believe that every police officer has to live in the city. I would say 25% we could afford to have outside the city and have half of them. I mean, I could arrange a schedule so that we're pretty sure that the people who live outside the city, half of them are in the city on duty, or a third on a 24-hour.
So that at any given time, 7/8 of the people would be here and available.
Right.
Okay. Well, a mayor has insisted that all of her top appointments in the police department, from the new chief on down, do live in the city.
Another thing that's going to help is the fact that if you see what's happening in the city, as the population goes down, but the demand for housing goes up, and the people in the suburbs realize that $4 a gallon gasoline is not going to get them to their jobs, I believe more and more people who move to the suburbs are going to be trying to move back in. So I would suggest that a lot of people, you know, would find it, if they could afford it, and if they could find a place to live, would choose to move back in.
Another advantage of having police live in the city is it gives you kind of a reserve force, because under California law, a peace officer off duty who observes a felony in progress automatically goes on duty and is supposed to take action. And he gets paid, or she gets paid, so that they're not being exploited in that sense. But what it means is that, and that goes along with the neighborhood argument, that they're protecting their own neighborhoods, and in fact they're not only empowered to do something if they see something off duty, but if it's a felony, they're required to take action.
I lived in a community in Maryland where the process had been for the police officers not to use their cars for personal use. And so they parked their cars in a garage every night. And then as a test, they decided to let them not use them for family and personal use, but to drive their police cars home, the ones that weren't. So they were parking their police cars in a driveway. Well, the crime went down. Because when there's a police car sitting on the block, the chances are that people will not commit a crime. I mean, the chances are less. And it also reminds neighbors that there's a police officer there. I mean, I just think the whole police-community relations is a really broad...
Have you met the new police chief yet?
Yes, I have.
Do you have any feedback for our Gay Life listeners about
Mr. Murphy? I think the assessment
that
I've heard throughout the community would be equal to my assessment.
Which
and I
is?
Think that's very positive, very positive. I think I'm, matter of fact, extremely pleased with Diane's appointment. I really thought she might muck that up.
Okay, and that's very honest coming from you who are a friend and so forth. Yeah, I met Chief Murphy briefly, and I'm impressed by how communicative he is. And I hope that soon we'll have him as a guest on the Gay Life when schedule quiets down
yeah.
a little. He's a bit busy. Among other things, he's looking for a house in San Francisco. But as for now, okay, moving away slightly from police issues, although ultimately we're dealing all with the same urban issues, because when we start talking about the Board of Permanent Appeals, we run into some of the same issues, neighborhoods, housing, safety on the streets. Now, there's some specifically gay things that come up before the Board of Permanent Appeals. There was a big muss about an all-night license for a disco in the Haight, the I-Beam. What happened on that? That was one of your first votes on the board, wasn't it?
It was just one of the first ones anybody took note of. there's a problem, and the problem is, do we want to, and I must say, San Francisco, as sophisticated as we think we are, rolls up its sidewalks pretty early in the evening. I mean, it's hard to go out for dinner, you know, at 9 or 10 o'clock at night. And when friends visit from the East, they're really surprised that at 9, as a matter of fact, it's hard to order a pizza after 10. So I'm not so certain that the government should be in a position of telling people what hours they should be experiencing things in their lives. There are a lot of people who work at night. There are people who drive cabs. There are people who are orderlies and nurses and doctors in hospitals.
People who work on newspapers and radio stations.
There are people who probably do that. There are people who clean the office buildings. There are, and they are night people.
People who have computer consultancies.
Those people. Now, if it's okay for the businessman at 5 o'clock to go have a cocktail at happy hour, which is a tradition, then what we're saying is that only people who work 9-to-5 jobs have that right. Now, I happen to have worked lots of hours, and you don't necessarily want to go to a bar at 1:30 in the morning when everybody else has been partying, and you can't try to catch up. So I'm not so certain that an after-hours place that allows you to let off energy, dance, which is good exercise, as long as they're within the realms and there's no crime going on, and as long as there's no discrimination. I mean, I don't want to see gay male discos that are only gay white men. Then I think that people in government really have to look at what they're governing. And in that particular case, in that particular business, they had gone through all the steps of the process of government in this city and had gotten their permit. And that's a long process, and it's an expensive process, and it's the second time they had done it, and they'd been allowed a permit. And even the police department said they should be given 90 days. Any problems within 90 days, including people parking in people's driveways, including any noise, including any disturbance in the neighborhood, any problems within 90 days, that permit would have been lifted. And I thought, and I voted to allow them that 90-day chance, because it was only Friday and Saturday night, and if the neighbors were really so obstinate against it, they could call and complain, and they could call me. And if that happened, then the permit would have been lifted, and it would have been an experiment. As it turned out, the neighborhood kept that experiment from happening, and I don't think that that's just. Now, on the other hand, the Board of Permanent Appeals saw an all-night restaurant that was going to cater to a different clientele, and the neighbors complained. And so I voted against them. I decided, let's be consistent. And yet the rest of the board decided, or at least enough decided, that the permit should go through. So I also want to see consistency in some cases. So if we're going to do it in the Haight, then I think we should do it at 19th and Lincoln Way.
So the people know what to expect from government, and there's a certain predictability.
Policy should be policy regardless of who the people are. And 19th and Lincoln is a neighborhood to me, and so is the Haight.
Okay, this is The Gay Life on KSAN, and we're talking to San Francisco Board of Permit Appeals Commissioner Joe Daly, a longtime lesbian activist in San Francisco. This year is an interesting year because 1980 means a presidential election, and the California primary comes up in June at the same time that Santa Clara County and San Jose will be voting on their gay rights ordinances. Now, as of this past week, Ted Kennedy, according to the National Gay Task Force, has just announced that he would sign an executive order banning discrimination in federal agencies and that he would support a gay rights plank at the 1980 Democratic Convention. Jerry Brown has already announced that he would do all of those and, in fact, has been using the gay community as seed money for the rest of his campaign, has made an early and strong bid for the gay vote. And Jimmy Carter is still silent on these issues. You have ties not only to the Democratic Party in the city, Joe, but to Democrats throughout the rest of the state through the California Democratic Caucus and other things. What's going to happen this year with a gay rights plank? What action are people going to take? Do you think there'll be a concerted effort of people of the gay community getting in behind Brown, or will there be division? What's going to happen at the convention?
I think at the convention we have probably the best opportunity to pass a gay rights plank for the party. I think that's absolutely true for two reasons. One is 50% of the delegates are going to be women. And although it was little noted among the gay press and media, what we learned at the IWOY conference in Houston was that women, no matter where they come from in the country, and no matter what their social status is, and no matter what race they are, really support civil rights for gay people and don't have problems with that issue. Therefore, we have a voting bloc of 50% women, and I think we have enough Democrats from doing our homework since 1972 who would also support a sensible, well-written gay rights plank.
What does that mean? What's a sensible, well-written gay rights plank?
Well, if I were on the committee, I would be very careful of not being too specific. In other words, I think as soon as we begin to talk about teachers or health workers or I think we can get gay rights passed if we don't scare people. And I think when we get too specific, we begin to scare people. San Francisco is not the rest of the country. San Francisco, what I mean by that is it was the most amazing thing to me. And, of course, history since then has sort of erased what happened here. But that 0-on-6 vote in San Francisco was extremely significant because the issue surrounding Proposition 6 took in two of the worst myths about us. One, that we're child molesters, which is absolutely not true. And the other is that perhaps we teach each other. I mean, perhaps gay rubs off somehow, and the teacher would be the person in the position who might be so influential that at an influential period of time in a child's life. Well, it took intelligent voters to see through that, and it also meant that they had to deal with the myths and trust us that we were telling them the truth.
Okay, now the statewide vote was about 55-45,
mm-hmm.
but in San Francisco it was about 3-1.
Mm-hmm. Or better.
Or higher.
Might have been 4-1.
Okay. So you were specifically talking about what happened in San Francisco as something unique, the strength
right.
of that vote?
Right. I mean, we shouldn't, I think we are, I think that the rest of the country's delegates at the convention might have difficulty seeing through an issue if we specified teachers. I mean, I think it should just be an overall sexual orientation.
Specifying non-discrimination, but
yeah.
not affirmative action.
Oh, absolutely no affirmative action. Absolutely. You can't have affirmative action if you can't identify people.
Right.
I mean, we could all turn purple. But no affirmative action. I think that really
scares
people, too.
The famous lavender fantasy. If we all woke up at lavender tomorrow morning, think how different things would be.
Yeah.
What about the what do you think that the existence of those referenda that are going to be happening, which will heat up in the last couple of weeks of the campaign, just as the national candidates move into California for their California primary drive, it's going to make it a very salient issue nationally.
I'm afraid I disagree with that, and I feel sorry about it. But as long as the Ayatollah is Carter's campaign manager,
the Iranian primary,
right? I think that we will be hearing fairly standardized responses from the candidates. Now, that doesn't make me feel too bad. What makes me feel much worse, and what makes me think we're in deeper trouble, is that also as long as the international crisis goes on, and I see that going on for a long time, no attention is going to be paid to the Equal Rights Amendment, which has a deadline.
1982.
Right. Gay rights doesn't have a deadline. And that concerns me very much, because if we don't get the Equal Rights Amendment passed, they can say all they want. I believe Carter did something with at least civil service and non-discrimination, and I mean, Carter did something that was significant in federal government as far as non-discrimination goes. One of the other problems is that I hope I can say this really clearly because it's important to me. If we want support locally in San Francisco, we have to recognize the other problems that other people have. And economic oppression is the biggest problem. And I know if you go to the grocery store and shop for yourself, you have to wonder how people who have kids, and 35% of gay women have children, how people who have kids are managing to feed them, take them to the dentist, buy them books for school. I mean, and I think we're looking at our oppression and not looking at what's an oppression to a lot of other people. And I think if we showed some concern and interest and at least let them know that we saw that single people, not just gay people, but single people recognize that families are also a legitimate lifestyle and recognize that they are being oppressed and they are in big trouble. We can survive as single people easier. And I don't know if I'm expressing that well enough, but as long as gay people only talk about gay issues and don't look at broader issues and limit it, I don't think most gay men realize how many gay women have children and families. I don't know how many gay men are also supporting children, but they're not certainly the people we see in the gay community out at meetings every night. So I suspect that they're just trying to keep their bodies and souls and children together. And I just think that there's just not enough concern expressed and enough, we're a pretty creative bunch of people. I think there should be a way that this, families should be able to afford to stay here. I mean, especially the ones who chose to stay here, regardless of whether their neighbors were black or Latino or Asian or gay.
Well, all right, I agree with you. I definitely agree with you in terms of that concern. I'm not sure I agree with you where you say that no one is taking account of it. I think, for instance, if you look at some of the activities of, say, the Alice B. Toklas Memorial Democratic Club, of which you're a longtime member, former officer, Harvey Milk Gay Democratic Club, that there is concern for these issues. And you find people in those clubs who are working on those other issues. You mentioned housing for a starter, and a lot of the housing organization and tenants activity in the city, there's a big contingent of gay people working on it. The whole move towards district elections was a move to get people who might be more sensitive to issues that are economically based, recognizing that some neighborhoods in the city are richer and some are poorer. So that, I mean, I think, and if you look at the candidates, non-gay and gay, that gay people have supported in the last set of elections, whether it's Harry Britt in District 5 or Nancy Walker in District 9, it's people who have concern for those issues. Just last week, in Mayor Feinstein's inaugural address, she made specific mention of the people who, I think she said, were passed by prosperity. I think there's a growing concern for that and a growing awareness of it.
I think you're right.
Is it that you don't see enough activity and mention? Are you talking about the gay press? Or are you talking about...
Maybe it's being discussed to death, but people are, I think now that Mayor Feinstein's in office, maybe some more things will happen, because one of her concerns has long been the flight of families to the suburbs, and not just middle-class families, but, the people who live in San Francisco should be able to live in San Francisco, whether they're straight or black. And I don't see, I guess what I'm saying is there are a lot of people who have been discussing it. And there's even some beginnings of some communications, but nothing has stopped. I mean, there's no moratorium. During the campaign, I know a couple of people who were doing surveys on Castro Street and discovered that most of the gays on Castro Street, first of all, didn't live in District 5, and second of all, hadn't been in the city more than 2 years. Well, I believe there is an influx,
mm-hmm.
and I believe that this is a city that is a city where survivors survive. Maybe more would happen in this city, and I don't mean this is a racial slur, but the richest and wealthiest people in the world right now are Arabs, or of the Arab nations. Now, I suppose that if all of 18th and Castro in that area began to be bought up because the prices were high enough and people were greedy enough and bought up by Arabs, and in London, all the for sale signs are in English and Arabic.
Mm-hmm.
And all the jewelry stores cater to Arabs.
Little
camel diamond rings. Now, mm-hmm. what I'm saying is that what I see, this could happen again. Now maybe we get some activity.
It may be happening in Marin County now.
Of course, it could be. I think in a lot of senses it is, and certainly in parts of Southern California. But what I'm saying is it isn't hurting gay people or single people, but it's hurting married people or people who choose to have children or people who chose in the past to have children or people who 10 years ago had a value system because our economy was totally different of saving their money, putting it in a bank, saving for the future. Well, now every day the money becomes less and less, so we have people with a value system, which is to spend. Get something as soon as you can because the price is going to go up. The 1980 census is going to blow the sociologists in our country off their asses because they're still playing 1960 sociology, and that's not reality. And maybe I'm speaking on a real broader scale, but I'd like to see somebody in the gay community stand up and say, wait a minute, these people in the areas they live in should not be forced out. And maybe we can think of a way that we can stop this. I mean, maybe there's a way we can at least just hold our horses before we send all the black people into the suburbs and all the white people in the suburbs who fled move back into the city. I mean, there's a lot going on that I think gay people look at just...
process, though. That's happening in cities throughout the country. It's called gentrification by mm-hmm. sociologists who are looking at it and economists. And it involves young white couples or singles. And it's in San Francisco particularly where a large number of those people are gay because of the established history and traditions of this city as well as the current political situation. If you would look, for instance, at Washington, D.C. or some neighborhoods of New York, you'd see the same process, I think, and there would be a gay component of it, except that the gay component wouldn't be as large a component of that move as it is here in San Francisco, where we have a large gay population in essentially a very small city.
Oh, yeah, and Philadelphia I'm very familiar with, too. But there's more, Randy. I mean, we have young women now, And young men now who are choosing to live together without marriage, so they have both their salaries, or live together and choosing when to have children and having less children and getting married later. I mean, there's a whole lot of things. After all, think about it now. The population of San Francisco has dropped immensely.
Maybe.
But the need for housing...
Maybe it's dropped immensely, because those are based on State Department of Finance studies, which, among other things, are extrapolations of the school enrollment. And I think that we will discover in the 1980 census that San Francisco has not lost nearly as much population as we think it has, and maybe even has gained, because I think a lot of the migration into the city of gay people and other young singles, married or unmarried without children, has in fact been invisible to the estimation techniques and the statistical models that the state has been using. And I think that as a result, San Francisco has been shortchanged in its state and federal monies as a result. That's my prediction about the 1980 census, is
that
we're going to show that San Francisco was underestimated. And for other reasons, too, which involves, for instance, the ones which are evident on a national basis, which is Latino population being underestimated because the people don't trust the Census Bureau because they think it's got something to do with the Immigration and Naturalization Service, La Migra. And in the black community, especially, where males are undercounted because people are afraid that they will lose certain social service benefits and don't trust the independence of the Census Bureau from the social services. So I think that altogether, I think San Francisco's, wouldn't it be nice if we found out that we were getting shortchanged and we suddenly got more money. But what do you think? What kind of solutions can one have for that kind of thing? How do we put a lid on it? How do we say, let's stop this from happening? We're creating a desirable place. I mean, the sociology and the city planning of the 60s was hoping that the cities would get revived this way. And now that it's happening, we're looking and saying, but what is this? Where are all these other people going to go?
But what short memories do we have, or am I getting really old? It was blockbusting in the 50s, and I lived in Northeast Washington, D.C. And as soon as one black family would move in, the cards didn't say, we can get you a lot of money for your house. The cards said, your neighbor has sold, perhaps you'd like to. And the property values went down. Okay, people took financial losses to get out of the cities. You can't stop that pendulum from swinging. Maybe you can't. But in a city our size, as small as we are, and as creative as I think most of us are, I don't hear yet whoever the gay leadership wants to, whoever wants to define themselves in positions of gay leadership, I don't hear them discussing that. I don't read about that in the Sentinel or the BAR or the Voice or the Crusader. I don't read about that. I don't even read about that in the Advocate. Mm-hmm. I mean, and I think we have to. Maybe there's just an expansion that I want, that just so I have more of a feeling that, sure, the activists are getting together and saying, what are we going to do about this? We're going to try rent control. But I just don't think it's... I think that the creative talent in our community does not lend its creativity to solving those kinds of problems, because those kinds of problems don't affect them as much, don't affect single people as much. You know, immigration, I'm glad you mentioned that, by the way.
Go. Why?
Because...
Why do you want to talk about immigration?
Because thinking about things on a broader scale, and I'm not saying we all should become international experts, but thinking of things on a broader scale, if what happened, if what the Carter administration did is true on gay immigrants, then gay immigrants in this country could possibly find themselves as illegal aliens.
Right.
Now, I think the American public has displayed an incredible amount of patience during this Iranian crisis. In the beginning, I thought we were going to see a real violent uproar. But people have been patient. I believe that most of the American citizens would have agreed with a federal judge who said, you can throw out illegal aliens, but you can't pick them out because they're Iranian students. I think that people would agree with that. But I believe that when this crisis ends, however that part of it ends, the hostage situation, that there's going to be a move in this country from left, right, and center to get rid of illegal aliens. And unfortunately, when they're looking at illegal aliens, maybe it'll be at the bottom of the line, but gay people are going to be included. Now, that's scary. And when I see the Equal Rights Amendment in incredible danger right now because of international politics, when I see the energy situation and the economy in a terrible mess because of international politics, and then when I see gay aliens or gay friends of mine not being able to cross the borders into this country because they're gay, then I really start to believe that the 80s are going to be worse than a repeat of the 50s. I mean, I'm waiting for 1990 for the social revolution now, and then I might be too old to enjoy it. But I wish that I'd see in the local gay, and I think other people in this city would like to see the so-called gay leadership really look at the problems that affect other people as well. Maybe now we'll care about aliens and what happens to them. Maybe we'll care about, there's a move that you shouldn't count the people in the Mission District who aren't citizens for federal funds, because after all, they're not citizens. So should they be receiving social services? I mean, when we're going to have to cut back on social services, should our tax rate be based on people who can't vote for those representatives? Or do we base it on a population? Could we have a population and a congressional district made up of absolutely nobody who could vote sometime? I mean, that's extreme, but
I think that move is unlikely to happen simply for the fact that we're going to be relying a lot on Mexican oil in the 80s, which gives the Mexican government a big leverage to protect its citizens in the United States. And I think another good example is what's going on in the Mission with this whole controversy over the lowriders seems to me is just a motorized version of the police attitudes towards people blocking sidewalks on Castro Street.
Absolutely.
They live in the suburbs and they're just not used to people who want to use the streets for socializing and
absolutely
looking for partners for whatever reason. I see a real big similarity between what happens at 24th and Mission and what happens at 18th and Castro, and that they're under the same police district.
Well, not only that, but when the police stop showing up in the Castro area, so I will admit drugs were sold openly on the street. People were using drugs on the street. I'm not against some drugs. When the crime rate began to go up, when women were being raped and beaten, and gays were being attacked, the question was, where were the police? I mean, my business is there. Where were the police? Well, I have a sneaky suspicion that the police weren't coming into the Castro, but the closest neighborhood for them to be is the Mission District. And I believe they're harassing young people who may be of a different culture, but I remember a low 1957 Plymouth, and we lowered it, but we didn't make it a work of art and so gorgeous that we wouldn't race it.
Mm-hmm.
These
or so gorgeous that hundreds of people would line the streets
to look
watch
at it.
Yeah,
this is an art. I think that I want to make sure that as long as I'm in government, and I always reassess when it's a good time to get out, that I have an open mind, and I'm afraid that in our city government right now, the people who are in charge of such things really don't have an open mind about it. I think there's an awful lot of racism involved with it. My God, I mean, when we were kids and guys wore leather jackets and duck hairdos, it scared people who were over 40. They thought they were all criminals. So now when you see the way that the Mission kids dress, it scares people who are over 30. I mean, they're afraid of them, and I don't see a tremendous difference. And I think they should have a place. I also thought Flyshacker Pool should be made into a skateboarding place where kids who like to skateboard could go do it for nothing.
Right, not have to worry about automobiles
and
worse. Well, your attitude of openness is certainly one that I think bodes well for San Francisco government in the 80s. I want to thank you for being here with us on The Gay Life this morning. We've been talking to Commissioner Joe Daly of the San Francisco Board of Permit Appeals, and I hope in the future when we'll be having some dialogues with other communities on this show, we'll invite you back to be one of our participants. Thanks a lot, Joe.
Thanks. It was fun.
And our next guest on The Gay Life this morning is Sharon Mills, the chairman of the Board of Women's Alternative Health Services. Good morning, Sharon.
Good morning.
Women's Alternative Health Services is attempting to start a lesbian clinic in San Francisco. That's basically what it wants to do, right?
Basically, yes. It'll be for women in general as well as for lesbians, but our primary focus is going to be on the health care needs of lesbians.
Are there specific health care needs for lesbians that differ from other women in very substantial ways?
No, not physically. More than anything, there's the risk of going to traditional practitioners and being humiliated about your sexuality or your lifestyle. And we believe that this has kept a lot of lesbians from seeking medical care. And for this reason, we think lesbians are underserved in the Bay Area, actually probably in the whole country, and that's why we're starting this clinic.
So that the problem would be that because women, lesbian women, don't feel that they will get sympathetic care, that they avoid it altogether and then thereby complicate?
Well, yeah, they don't get routine preventive medical checkups. And, for instance, pap smears, one group that we studied last year, had an interval between their pap smears twice as long as women in general. So we think they're not getting enough preventive care. And sometimes even probably if certain lesbians have medical problems, they're reluctant to go to traditional practitioners to get medical care for fear this might come up and they'll have to answer it, and then they'll be humiliated.
What forms do those humiliations take? Now, this would come from – there's a general problem, I think, of male medical care providers, doctors and so forth, tending to humiliate women of whatever sexual orientation.
True, yeah, there's sexist and heterosexist problems. There are some verbal and nonverbal forms of humiliation, and sometimes it can be in the form of just, you know, a look. If a practitioner asks, a funny look or
the raised eyebrows.
Yeah, the raised eyebrows, or maybe they won't look at you anymore, or maybe they'll rush through the rest of the interview in physical, or maybe they'll say something. You know, they'll either make a joke that's humiliating, or maybe they'll actually lecture a woman about her sexuality.
And enough lesbians have this problem or have had been hassled in the past that you feel that it makes them reluctant to seek the regular medical care that any human should get.
That's right. The Bay Area Physicians for Human Rights did a study last year that asked gay men and women, actually, if they had come out to a practitioner, and whatever percentage of the group had come out, I think 25 to 30% of these people had a negative reaction from their practitioners, and that's really too much of a risk to take when you're going to someone that's supposed to be helping you.
And with whom you want to have enough trust to share
exactly
whatever elements of lifestyle. Now, one of the things that mainstream medicine has learned in the 70s is the way in which it's important to deal with the whole people. And even some of the most conservative medical practitioners now understand the ways in which lifestyle elements such as stress affect overall health.
Right.
What specific kind of services would a lesbian clinic in San Francisco be able to provide beyond the medical?
Well, I think we would like a lot of alternative clinics that are springing up now, combine more of a holistic approach to health care than the traditional system. But it's not going to be a holistic in terms of, herbal medicine or, really, really far out stuff. It's pretty much traditional practice, except that I think the practitioners that are going to be working there are going to be sensitive, very sensitive to the, psychological needs as well as the physical needs of the women that are coming into the clinic. And the health services don't really differ from what you would get, in a traditional practice, except that it would be more sensitive, which is really important.
So that, for instance, it would be like having a lesbian family doctor. I mean, when I talk about holistic, a lot of the holistic stuff just goes back to the old general practitioner stuff of the 19th century,
right,
where the physician was familiar enough with the social and psychological circumstances of the family that he could say that, and in the 19th century it was he, little Johnny isn't really sick, he's just freaked out because
right,
his father's been away for so long or something like that.
Yeah. And we're also going to encourage women that have partners to come in with their partners. And the health history questionnaires that we're going to be using really do go into, what's going on in their life right now. I think that's a very important part of I mean, you know, obviously we all think that's a really important part of a person's health. So the family, in terms of if a lesbian and her partner or whoever else may be involved in that relationship, if they're children, you know, we want to know about them. We won't be seeing children in the clinic, but we will want to know about the families, and we do encourage the partners to come in.
Where would you ideally locate this clinic? Have you located a lesbian neighborhood in San Francisco?
No, I haven't. I think Noe Valley would probably be a good place to have a clinic like that. It's central enough, and I think that I don't know of a lesbian neighborhood in the city, but I think there probably are a really significant number of them living in Noe Valley.
And what would full staffing for this clinic be? Who do you want to have staffing it? How many MDs? How many nurse practitioners?
Well, right now we have about it's an all-volunteer staff at the present, and there are currently somewhere in the neighborhood of 8 to 10 physicians and 8 nurse practitioners and about another 10 miscellaneous health workers, nurses, LVNs, health educators. And so these people will be staffing at some, and then a few office workers, 4 or 5 office workers.
So these are all people who are ready and willing to go to work.
Right. Right.
Okay. What do health educators do?
They answer questions that come up. Like if a person were filling out a questionnaire and we were asking questions, and they would answer questions that would be on the questions that they didn't understand, or they may have questions about their own health, some concern if they have a symptom. Or if somebody they know has a symptom, or they may just want to know basically what's a good diet. Am I getting enough exercise? They may have questions about smoking. And one of the things that we're concerned about is to educate women about diethylstilbestrol in utero, which was the DES that was given in the 50s a lot, 50s and 60s to pregnant women to prevent miscarriages. And so these women that were exposed in utero at the time now are at increased risk for types of vaginal cancer.
In fact, there is some growing evidence that there may be a problem with DES sons and testicular cancer.
Yeah, right.
Although most of the problem that's surfaced so far is definitely a women's problem.
Right.
The questions that you said would be asked of a health educator, it seems to me that if we're having health educators in clinics, and I think that's a good idea, but it would seem to indicate that probably health education in schools has fallen down, if in fact people don't know by the time they leave schools what is a good diet, what's the proper amount of exercise. Do you feel that? Do you think that?
I don't know what's going on in schools right now as far as health education. And maybe people learn it or maybe they don't absorb it in school, but sometimes when people get out in life and start getting into bad habits or habits that they may have questions about, they really, really know the answer themselves and want to have it affirmed. Sometimes they really don't know what good diets are. And food right now, as far as food goes, it's so much of it is packaged and advertised, and so much junk is put in it that I think people really don't forget about, or either sort of basically just forget about what's in a lot of food and probably forget how to take care of themselves.
I know that my experience of what health education I was given in schools, I could tell even then that a lot of it had to be bad information because it gave the same information for everybody. And even though I wasn't out of the closet and didn't even to myself and didn't even realize the extent to which I was different from a lot of other people, I knew that there were a lot of individual differences that weren't being taken into account. I'm not saying that gay people need separate diets or anything like that. But I mean, like, just knowing that there are a lot of individual differences told me that when they gave you the same information and said this applies to everyone made it highly suspect to me.
Right, yeah. That's true.
So that I never really trusted a lot of that stuff. And maybe some of it was right and I've thrown out the baby with the bathwater or whatever. We're talking on The Gay Life to Sharon Mills, who's with a group called Women's Alternative Health Services, which is right now involved in the process of setting up a clinic for lesbian and other women in San Francisco. What's the big obstacles? Money?
Well, money's always an obstacle when you're going about something like this. No, money is not the primary obstacle right now. There's actually some technicalities that are holding us up from getting our site and getting open, but I think they'll be resolved by the middle of the week, and that it will be open around the end of January or the beginning of February.
So it's really almost about to happen.
Yeah, it's about to happen. We're just about ready ourselves, and we're sort of tying up loose ends, but basically there's just a couple of technicalities with the site and with our clinic license, but we're going.
In a few more minutes, we'll give people a phone number to call so that they can get information on opening dates and the eventual address. So if you're interested, grab a pencil and paper now so that when we give it to you, you'll be ready to take it down. Where did the funding come from then, if it's...
We've been doing fundraising projects since we decided to incorporate, we incorporated in June of this year.
Nonprofit corporation.
Nonprofit corporation, and so that we could get grants if they were going to be available from foundation grants, whatever, or donations. And so we've done several projects. The first one was a public appeals letter that went out in August, and then we did a raffle, which was very successful, and we had a concert December 1st with Margie Adam, Robin Flower, Joan Balter, and Nancy Vogel, which raised actually the last bit of money that we needed to get open. And when the clinic is open, we'll be charging fees for services, which we hope will be low cost, and we'll have it on a sliding scale. But probably most of our funds will come from fees for services, and fundraising will be an ongoing function.
Will you be able to accept Medi-Cal or other insurance plans?
Yes. We're applying for both of those.
Okay. Now, you mentioned that in addition to ongoing fundraising and receiving fees for services and so forth and insurance, is there any interest in this group towards providing some kind of prepaid plan where a health maintenance type organization is...
No,
that
to do,
is an approach.
Not now. To do that, you would need a hospital to affiliate with, so that if someone became ill enough to need to be hospitalized, or if they needed some surgery that even wasn't serious, you'd need a hospital to affiliate with, and we don't have that right now, and because there's no way that we can really work our billing in with theirs, with those of hospitals right now. Kaiser is one such organization, and that's just a huge corporation, and we don't have plans to do anything like that. It would be nice eventually, but I'm sure that would be years off if we had something like that.
Yeah, I mean, it seems to me that the kind of approach that you want to take with dealing with the whole people, that there's some strength in that, and yet organizations like Kaiser, which have a whole prepaid thing and which put an economic premium on having people and the doctors and so forth work to maintain health, rather than to deal with it afterwards, that because you need a hospital, but all of the clinics that they have where they intake on general problems are associated with hospitals, wouldn't it really be more logical to have a lot more neighborhood and specialized use clinic-like clinics that dealt almost exclusively with lesbians or clinics that had a largely gay male clientele, and then that associated with a hospital for when that was needed, rather than having the clinics directly attached and in hospitals all the time?
That could probably work out. I certainly wouldn't want to see a lesbian hospital have to be isolated from a mainstream hospital, because then we don't get a chance to educate other health professionals about lesbians as clients, healthcare consumers.
Sure.
and coworkers.
But I mean, as opposed to saying having a lesbian clinic that was associated with a general hospital as part of some plan. That is the thing I never understood about Kaiser was why. I mean, yes, you need hospitals when you're having a health maintenance organization, but why do you always have to have the clinics right there as hospital attached, as opposed to being places where...
Yeah, I see what you mean. Yeah. That would be nice. That would really just be a financial technicality, working out something like that. But probably we will eventually be affiliated with more with one hospital than with others, most likely, although I can't say for sure. But we certainly would like to be affiliated with a hospital that would be, that the workers in it would be sensitive to the needs of lesbians.
You just mentioned another aspect, which is the need to educate non-gay health professionals as to the needs of both lesbians and gay men. How is that going about? Is it purely a question of personal association, or are there any formal programs being undertaken?
There have been a few formal programs done at some of the local universities, university hospitals, and I don't know what the attendance has been like, you know, among the non-gay health professionals, but I know there is an effort going on by some gay health workers, gay and lesbian health workers, to, you know, provide some courses in it, and there are a few groups now that have that as, you know, as their goals.
What about going around to hospitals and healthcare facilities to deal with people who are already not students of healthcare, but people who are already practicing and so forth, and who have gone through all of their formal education, but are out there where we have a whole generation or two of people who are out there? Is there being any attempt to reach them?
I don't know what's going on in the private sector, but I imagine that most hospitals of any size have certain in-service health education for their professionals, even if they're already out. And that I don't know if that's going on in the private ones or not. It's going on mostly in the university ones, as far as health, you know, health education for gay people, you know, for gay clients.
Okay, and you mentioned there are several organizations that are working on this, educating people. What are those organizations?
There's one organization called the San Francisco Women's Health Center that is planning doing it. I think it's already done some education like that, and they're also working on some other programs right now. And there was another group. It may be affiliated with UC. I think there was a gay health workers group at UC that did a presentation for their physicians. And there are individuals that have presented in grand rounds or whatever, in places like UC.
You mentioned an organization called Bay Area Physicians for Human Rights, which is dealing with the education of health professionals and ensuring...
Right, they do that too.
Doing studies and so forth. That's just physicians. You, for instance, are a nurse practitioner. Are lesbian and gay health workers organized at among nurses and nurse practitioners and so forth,
yeah,
as well as among physicians?
In fact, there's a group called Gay and Lesbian Health Workers that basically is a large number of a lot of different kinds of health care workers, but, you know, among them are nurses and nurse practitioners and other kind of health workers.
How long has that organization been going on?
I think they've existed for about a year and a half or 2 years.
So there's lots of activity. We have educational activity. We have the foundation of a new clinic. We have Bay Area Physicians for Human Rights organized. And in the area of healthcare, it's more than simply a kind of caucus for other professional organizations, for instance, have gay caucuses and lesbian caucuses. But here there are some specific health needs to be dealt with and specific education that has to be done of other health professionals.
Right.
So it's more than just mutual support. And I shouldn't say just mutual support. Mutual support is a very important thing. But there's all this going on. Now, people who want to get in touch with the clinic should – it's pencil and paper time, folks – should reach you at what number?
At 824-6491.
During regular business hours?
There's an answering machine, so they can call just about any time of day.
And they can find out then where the clinic will be located?
Yes, that information will be available next week.
Next week.
And they can find out where it will be located and when it'll be open.
Okay, and or if they are willing to volunteer services or skills.
We can always use volunteers. So if anyone's interested in volunteering, they can give me a call, the same number.
Okay, I want to repeat the number again for the people.
It's 824-6491.
Okay, we've been talking to Sharon Mills of Women's Alternative Health Services. Thank you for being our guest on The Gay Life this morning, Sharon. We've enjoyed talking to you.
Thank you.
If you're listening on Saturday morning, don't forget the March on Sacramento on Sunday, January 13th. Call 864-2748 for more details. And the Gay Freedom Day Committee is having nominations on Sunday, January 20th at the Metropolitan Community Church at 150 Eureka Street at 5 o'clock. That about wraps it up on The Gay Life this morning. Our guests have been Board of Permit Appeals Commissioner Joe Daly and nurse practitioner Sharon Mills. The Gay Life is engineered by Rick Sadle and produced by me, Randy Alfred. I also write two columns, Taking Sides and On Live, for The Sentinel, which is available in gay neighborhoods throughout San Francisco. If you're listening on Saturday morning, this show will be repeated late Sunday night at 1 a.m., so please tell a friend about The Gay Life on KSAN.